and welcome to the Outrider Podcast. I am Jason Quinn Malott, and this is episode 23, the first episode back from my month-long hiatus so I could get my poop in a group, as someone I knew once said. And today's guest is Taylor Molly. Taylor is a poet, probably one of the few poets out there that actually makes his living as a poet, and itinerant teacher of poetry, encourager of teachers, recruiter of teachers. You'll find out about that in the podcast. And I'll put some links to, of course, all of his important information in the show notes, so you can go and check out his website and a bunch of other stuff he's involved in. I first met Taylor when I was an undergrad at Kansas State University. He was in the grad program. We took a workshop with the poet Jonathan Holden. We talk about that a bit here at the very beginning of the show. And I've kind of always wanted to talk to him. I've been keeping tabs on his career, and it's fascinating. For those of you who don't know, and you might see this in the bio when you look it up, but I'm going to tell you about it. He's a four-time champion, National Poetry Slam champion, was a semi-regular or most, well, you'll hear about it in the podcast, but he was involved with the Deaf Poetry Jam that Russell Simmons put on that was on HBO in the early 2000s. And, of course, it's one of his performances, for those of you who are English teachers or interested in English, has probably seen it around on YouTube. That was the one that kind of launched him and made him the poetry celebrity that he is. Before we get to the actual conversation with Taylor, I would like to extend a huge thanks to the Kansas Association for Teachers of English. The Kansas Association of Teachers of English. I think that's the Kate people. They were gracious enough to allow me to crash the last day of their conference here in Wichita so that I could talk with Taylor while he was in town. They were also very kind at Taylor's behest and fed me lunch along with them at the luncheon. And there's a little break in the podcast where we stop the interview, we go to the luncheon, he performs, and he recorded a video for that, and I'll try and link to some of that stuff also in the show notes, so you'll want to check it out. It's fantastic. But they fed me, they let me crash their thing and hog about an hour's worth of time of Taylor's while he was there to speak to their teachers and their students. They were very kind and very generous, and I appreciate it tremendously. They are wonderful people, particularly Elaine, who was my primary contact there, as well as my friend Stacy. So thank you, Elaine. Thank you, Stacy, Steve, Rob, everybody who's a member of Kate, for letting me crash your event to talk to Taylor. So let's get right to it. Let's talk to Taylor Molly.
Fabulous odor, new and improved act of cowardice. You can't. Yeah, what did you just click off? Because I'm hitting a little bit of an echo. Where is that coming from?
Okay, that might just be the distance from the mic. They're a little sensitive, but I've got all the doodads that I can. And it might be a bit of an echo.
So my mic is picking, your mic is picking up my voice.
I think so.
So let's.
Or we might be a little too close to the actual microphones. Everything's. I'm still kind of new at this after about a year or so now of doing it, and I've only done three or four live ones. Everything's been over the phone.
Yeah, this sounds better. A little better. Well, maybe if I speak quieter, then I don't.
No, I think we'll be fine. I'll tweak some volume on the back end and post, as they say, I guess.
Okay.
So we're rolling. Taylor, great. Thanks for agreeing to meet me here.
You have to understand where we are. We're in a conference room at a Marriott hotel. The Kansas Association of Teachers of English is going on right now. I have a sister named Kate, and I was hoping that they would have more swag, bags and mugs and tote bags and things and lanyards that say Kate on them, because I could bring them to my sister Kate, whom I love, but they don't. Anyway, Jason, very nice to meet you, and thank you for coming out.
Well, we've actually met before, way back in the days at K-State.
Remind me.
We were in a workshop that Jonathan Holden led. I think Jana Leap was in there, a guy named Wes Beal.
Right. Jonathan Holden was one of the reasons I went to K-State.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I was living in the Bay Area, and a woman who I was dating got into the University of Missouri at Columbia for journalism school. And she said, I'm going to go to Columbia. We can either break up, which is what we should have done. Try to maintain a long distance relationship with you in Berkeley and me in Columbia. Mm-hmm. Or you can come to Columbia and flip burgers for 2 years while I get my master's degree in journalism. And I said, hold on. There's a third option, a fourth option. What if I went to graduate school too? And she said, oh yeah, in what? And I said, poetry. I went to drama school. I write performative poems. Maybe right. I could find a graduate program, you know, in a contiguous state. And so I ended up going to Kansas State, Manhattan, which is 4 hours from Columbia, Missouri.
Right.
My friends in Berkeley said, you know, you could have flown from Oakland to Kansas City in less time it would take you to drive. So, but I loved my time in Kansas.
Yeah.
I loved my time in Kansas. So great to be back.
So where are you from originally then?
I'm from the Big Apple.
The big one.
Originally. Okay. But it was very interesting that at KSU, when people would say, where are you from? And I would say, I was actually born and raised in Manhattan. My family has lived in Manhattan since the 1650s. And they would go, right. But the town was only founded in the 1880s. And they would say, well, I'm just that mysterious.
So what did your parents do? You born and raised in the Big Apple, right? Or in that area?
Yeah, no, in that area. I'm the 10th generation of people to be born on the island of Manhattan. So I have my ancestors are Dutch.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
It wasn't even called Manhattan. It was New Amsterdam. Predates the country, right? And so I have Dutch and Scottish and English and French ancestry, and both of my parents were also born in New York, as were all four of my grandparents. And my father worked for a company called HWT Molly and Company, which was the family business, and they sold billiard cloth. They just went out of business. They were founded in New York in 1827.
Wow.
And they sold billiard cloth, that heavy felt that goes on billiard tables. And it's a random thing, but that's what they did. And there weren't that many other people who did it. So.
And was it family owned the whole time?
Yeah.
Wow.
Not eventually, when my father, right before he died, he got out of it, got into a spat with his brother, who was the president. So I haven't, my family hasn't been involved in it for the last 20 years, but I understand they just went out of business, which is so, because I would have loved to have taken that over and said, okay, we're no longer a billiard felt company. I'm going to fire all the employees. Well, because they lost their jobs anyway. I would have turned it into something else.
Yeah.
But Molly and Company for 100 and, you know, that's almost a 200-year-old company.
Right. Wow. That's... Because most family-owned businesses, if they stay around for a while, only don't get up to like the fifth generation. They don't last even that long, which is amazing. My mom's side of the family is in the funeral home business, and there's been a Hitzman funeral home in Chicago since the early 1900s, and it's still family-run. So it's amazing.
Is it still, and your mother's family is still?
Yeah, but her father was one of 16. And it was her grandfather who was the mortician that owned it. So the cousins that run it now, she hasn't talked to in years.
See, my poetic brain, I already am writing a poem about the mortician whose only dodge against death was to have 16 children.
Yep. So how did you get, you said your original degree was in theater, right?
Not quite. No, I went to Bowdoin College up in Maine, and I was an English major because they didn't have a theater major.
Okay.
I would probably have been a theater major if they had had one, and thank God they didn't, because I would have forever been plagued by one of two questions. One is, if you're serious about your education, why did you become a theater major? Or if people had said, if you're really serious about becoming an actor, why did you go to Bowdoin College up on the coast of Maine? So I was an English major because back then in the 80s, all of the theater classes, the acting and directing and the technical theater and the playwriting classes, they were all under the auspices of the English department. Mm-hmm. So I graduated as an English major with, I think, more credits in the English department than anyone ever had or since now, because I think now they do have a theater major.
Right.
But I was a, you know, I was an actor. I was a performative kid, a histrionic child. Apparently, even before I could talk, I would stand at the edge of my crib and hold onto the rail like it was a church pulpit. And I would, you know, preach my gospel without words to whoever would listen.
Did you have any ministers in the family?
No. No.
Interesting.
No. I'm the closest thing that the family has to a minister. One of my uncles, who has now passed on, when he first heard me do what I do and call it poetry, he said, "Those aren't poems. Those are sermons."
Sermon.
And I said, "That's, I can live with that."
Right.
I can live with that. So I always had a histrionic side, but I was an English major. And then when Rebecca moved us to the Midwest, uh-huh. and she to Columbia and I to Manhattan, I was going to study poetry with Jonathan Holden, the class where we,
right.
where you and I met to get to circle around. And Jenna Leap, who I think is a doctor.
Yeah, that's what I heard. And I thought I had found her on, you know, the KU Med website and tried sending her an email, but I never heard back.
Well, she's a doctor.
Yeah, she's
They're so busy. They're so busy. Oh, I loved her. I admired her from afar. I think I wrote her a secret. She was such an iconic and
very charismatic and just.
And out there, I remember I used to pass around dental floss in class. And if the teacher would, nobody flosses enough, you know?
Right.
And so I would say, "Would you mind if we all floss? We're totally listening." And you know, some teachers would say, "Oh, no, that's great. Here, give me some too." And Jana accepted the floss and said, "Do you like flossing too? Because you like the taste of blood?" And I was like, "Wait, what?" She's like, did I say that out loud?" So, yeah.
And like Holden and his pack of extra gum that he always passed around.
Oh, I don't remember that.
Yeah.
He was one who would let me floss in class and also pass around the floss. But I went to Kansas State for... my degree, undergrad, is in English, and right out of college, I mm-hmm. went to drama school in Oxford for a little bit, a program designed to get American actors to
right.
train with members of the Royal Shakespeare Company.
Oh, wow.
And listen, and now I'm a performance poet, but on a daily basis, I am probably using at least as much of what I learned in drama school mm-hmm. as what I did in graduate school, becoming a right. better poet.
That's something that has always impressed me about you, as I've watched you after K-State and saw you pop up and then eventually on the internet and YouTube and everything like that. It was that, and oddly enough, there was at the graduate reading that you and a bunch of other MA students had, you had performed a poem that was making fun of the way poets read.
I'm so impressed that you remember this, because we're talking 21 years ago.
Yeah. Well, that's
and that poem was called "What I Think I Could Be a Poet."
Okay, I didn't remember the title. I just remember.
Well, I'll do a couple of lines. You tell me if it's the same one.
Yeah.
I think I could be a poet because I like to wear a lot of black, and I have studied the poets who sing song out their lines mm-hmm. for no other reason than that's how it's done.
Right.
In love with the sound of their own voices. Ending every line going up, right? Yeah, oh good.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm so, you know, that is...
Oh, that's poisoned my enjoyment of every poetry reading I've gone to ever since. Because once, you know, the minute that poet opens his mouth and just goes on and on, I'm sitting in the back.
Taylor Molly, that guy I knew back in the early 90s.
He ruined performance poetry for me. I mean, nobody else does it like that.
And people have said that. I just, you're here at this conference, and I'm going to be speaking I'm the keynote at lunch. Mm-hmm. I don't know when you air these, but today is Halloween, October 31st, 2014. And I'm the keynote speaker at this Kate conference, where they do not have mugs. Or tote bags,
oh, no.
or lanyards, or even pens. But they arranged to have me speak to some high school students, and I just finished doing a poetry, performance poetry workshop with a bunch of area high school students who don't all know each other, but they've been working on spoken word. And sometimes when I teach a class like that, and I'll start with the nervous tics that people often have, saying or ah or when they speak, or moving in a certain way, or if you ever see a poet do this, it's because they don't know what to do with their hands.
Right.
If you ever see a poet do this, it's because they're afraid of standing still. And people will come back to me months later and say, I went to a poetry reading after that class and you ruined it. I could not listen to a single thing anybody said because I was analyzing the way they were saying
it. Yeah, the only other poet that really amazes me when she reads is Anne Waldman. It's just because everything is flamboyant with her. You know, she's got half a dozen scarves on. One time when I was in graduate school, she was doing a reading and she was crawling under a piano while she was going, it's fabulous.
Well, Anne Waldman, for those who don't know, is one of the most, she's probably the only, the most famous of the beat poets. She's considered Allen Ginsberg's spiritual wife.
Mm-hmm.
Wild, very photogenic exotic looking woman. And she is very performative. And I run a series in New York called Page Meets Stage, mm-hmm. where the Pulitzer Prize meets the Poetry Slam. And for 9 years, we've been taking two poets, one more performative and one more literary or academic. And like no other reading, they read back and forth. They do a poem for poem for poem. And what I love, Anne has done it. And what I love about having her is that she's not a slam poet.
Right.
You know, usually the performative poets, the poets I get to represent the stage, are ex-slam poets.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is one of those opportunities that I was able to have, you know, a beat poet. She was fabulous.
Yeah. Speaking of slams, that's kind of, from my understanding, is where you first got recognized. And there were some slams, I think, that were going on in Manhattan when we were at K-State, just some informal stuff at the coffee shops. How did you go from that? I mean, how long was it after graduate school when you had that first championship slam poem?
I graduated from K-State in 1993, and I won the first National Poetry Slam championship 3 years later in 96.
Cool.
But just to correct the record,
yes,
I don't believe there was ever a poetry slam even at the Café Royale.
They just called it that?
I don't think anybody, I mean, in order for it to be a poetry slam, mm-hmm. you need to have judges.
Right.
You need to pick five randomly selected, racist, homophobic, bigoted judges to give scores to mm-hmm. poems as they get drunker and drunker.
Right.
So I discovered, you know, to his credit, Larry Rogers, who was on my master's committee, mm-hmm. along with Jonathan and Elizabeth Dodd, who the other poet who I was thrilled to study with at K-State, Larry Rogers said, hey, have you heard about this thing called Poetry Slam? They do it over in Lawrence on the fourth Monday of every month.
Right.
At the Flamingo Exotic Lounge catering topless bar. Where on the fourth Monday of every month, they would give the dancers the night off. Mm-hmm. The Flamingo, as far as I know, it's still in Lawrence. And that was my routine. I would go to the Flamingo, and then actually, I think we would leave. How far a drive is it from Manhattan to Lawrence?
About 90 minutes.
Yeah. So we would leave. We would have dinner at the Free State Brewery. Is that still there? The Free State?
I don't know.
They had an Ad Astra Pale Ale.
Yeah.
Is that still the state motto? Ad Astra per Aspera, which is to the stars with difficulty. So we would have a couple of beers and have dinner, and then we would go to the Flamingo and watch the poetry slam, and then do a poem in the open mic. Then this is probably 1992. Then they asked me to be in the slam, and so the very first slams I ever went to were in Kansas.
Right.
I never organized one back in Manhattan because I was a grad student and I really wasn't supposed to have time for that. I did organize a slam in Maine, and I took a team to the national championships in 1994, first year out of grad school. We made it to the finals, but we didn't win. Same thing in 95. And then I won in 96. again awesome. In 97, again in 2000, and then for the final time in 2002.
Nice. And it was those two championships that got you on the Deaf Poetry Jam?
Probably part of that. Well, those three, because I won 96, 97, and 2000. And I think Deaf Poetry Jam started in 2001, because I know that the first taping was supposed to be September 12th of 2001. So they had to push that back because of September 11th. And so about a month. And so it is probably the notoriety or the exposure that those slams got. I mean, that's actually not true, because in the New York City spoken word community,
right.
I moved back to New York as a teacher in 1996, in the fall of 96, and started going to poetry slams and started my own poetry slam there. Not the new Eurekan Poets Cafe, which is the famous poetry slam and still is there. And that's been around since maybe 1989 or 90.
Wow.
But the guys who originally had the idea for Deaf Poetry Jam, they needed money for it. And then to get money, they needed to sort of go to HBO, you know, and say, hey, would you give us money to put on a show? And the HBO guys said, a show like what? And they would say, well, you mean you need us to put on the show so that you can see what kind of show? You know, TV executives are famous for not having that much imagination. You know, there's the pitch meeting, but if the pitch meeting goes well, they go, okay, what are you talking about? So there were several sort of pre-Deaf Poetry Jam shows that we put together as we were sort of figuring out what the show would be like. And 2 years in a row, HBO invited us to the Comedy Arts Festival in Aspen and said, you know, we knew we were being considered for a regular show. And they said, you know, we'll have a couple of executives come and watch your show. So we put on a mini, not mini, because it was a half hour show, and that's what the show ended up being. And we would, here's eight poets doing one or two poems. So I, from the very beginning, I was involved in doing these early iterations of the show that became Deaf Poetry Jam. In fact, I was the original Most Deaf.
Nice.
But then they decided, you know what? If we're going to go to prime time here, we need
somebody with a name.
With a name. And also, since Russell Simmons was behind it, it's like, let's have somebody who's a little more hip hop than the Wasp from New York City.
Yeah, I stumbled across footage of that, you know, on YouTube later on, because when that was happening, I was in graduate school and did not have a TV.
You should not, as no one should when they're in grad school. I didn't have a grad school when I was in television. When I was at K-State, from 90 to 93, I did not have a television. Consequently, I did not know that the Allied forces that were going in to liberate Kuwait, I did not know that they would be colored the same. The camouflage would be the color of the desert.
Right.
When the first time I saw that on TV, I said, oh my God, look at that. And they said, what? I said, well, the way the tanks are colored, they blend in with the desert. And somebody said, Taylor, the whole point of camouflage is that it blends in with the, what did you think camouflage looked like?
Right.
And I was born in 1965. So I said, camouflage is supposed to be like dark green to blend in with the jungles of Vietnam, you know? And so it was really odd for me. I also didn't know that Anita Hill was black.
Really?
Yeah. So I didn't know. Yeah. It's like, why is this such an issue? Oh, and then like Newsweek comes out and I was like, oh, I see there's a whole element to this I didn't see.
You know,
when you only get your news from NPR, there's a visual element that you're missing. So no, you shouldn't own a TV in grad school. That's part of why I got a 4.0 in grad school, because I didn't have a TV. Continue.
Yeah, I missed a 4.0 in graduate school by an A-.
Oh,
an A-.
Oh, it sucks to be you.
Like a 3.9.
It sucks to have been you.
Yeah, let me tell you. And that was quite an accomplished, though, after my undergraduate years, which was, hovering in the high C average.
How did you do in Jonathan's poetry class?
I don't remember. It was A or a B or something. I don't know. It was up
there. It was, so you were an undergrad in this poetry class
that also
had graduate students. Did you feel that there was like a divide between the grad students? Or did you ever look at us and go, wait, why? That's not good. Why are all the grad students oohing and aahing over this poem that doesn't make any sense?
No, I didn't feel like there was really any kind of a divide. And I think it was because I was also hanging out with Jana outside of class. So it was just something else, you know?
And because she was undergrad too, right?
No, at the time I think she was.
Nope.
She was.
Nope. She was a senior in mine. She was never in the grad program during the 3 years that I was there.
Yeah. See, I don't remember anything.
I could be wrong. But it would be the first time. Oh, I'm such a dick.
So I don't think I have all of your books, and I don't of course have the Outlaw American Poetry thing.
You do have all of my books. I'm looking at them. You have a hardcover first edition of What Teachers Make, and you have a hardcover first edition of The Last Time As We Are, What Learning Leaves, and The Bouquet of Red Flags. You must have just bought that here.
Yeah, I picked it up.
Because it comes out tomorrow.
Yeah, I picked it up at Watermark on the way over. I had one special ordered.
Oh, I had, my opinion of you just went up. Because that book doesn't even, and Watermark, that's good for them for getting it.
Well, I think they're selling copies.
It is officially out tomorrow.
I think they're selling copies here at the event.
They're all gone, but yes.
So.
I mean, I have them, but yes. I didn't think that anybody else did.
Well, that's one of the benefits of not only being really close with your local independent bookstore, but having worked there and dated the inventory manager, is that... You know, as soon as a book comes in, it's usually two things happen. I know a book's coming out months in advance because I know writers. So I say, hey, put one on order for me. And so it's there waiting for me. Or they know me well enough to go, hey, you might like this.
You might like this, yeah.
For me or, you know, like this
well,
one.
Well, I will sign all of those, but it doesn't make for good radio. So,
Right. So was it, I'm trying to remember, did the Outlaw Poetry Bible, did that come out? Before or after the Deaf Poetry Jam?
I don't know.
Just wanted to know how that TV appearance how that affected your trajectory. You think did it increase in interest or were people already interested?
Here's what I would say. I mean, it was a huge honor to be on 3 seasons of Deaf Poetry Jam. When you go and you tape for Deaf Poetry Jam, the best thing about the show is that it's half an hour. So when you're watching it and you think, I think I might want to go to the bathroom and get a beer. Oh, it's over. You know, here comes Most Deaf and Russell Simmons at the end to say, thanks a lot, everybody. God bless you. Good night. As he did at the end of every show. But the show, a half hour show, takes about 2 hours to film. And that partly because there's a little bit of stop and go and whatnot. But also they invite more poets than they use. Mm-hmm. And everybody gets to do 2 poems. So, you know, a half hour show, it usually had 6 or 7 poets on it. But when they taped, they would invite 10 poets to come on stage, be introduced by Most Deaf, and you do 2 poems. And if you're lucky, they choose 1. And if you're not lucky, they choose neither.
Right.
So it was a thrill to be on that show. But I would not be where I am today if YouTube had not been invented 4 years later.
Oh, right, right.
I owe my career more to YouTube than I do to Deaf Poetry Jam. Although somebody, you know, very early on, somebody put I don't know how they got, maybe they came out on a DVD and they ripped them and burned them and upload them. The poem that really blew up on YouTube was a version of What Teachers Make that was filmed at the 2000 National Championships. And And that was the one that got, I don't know, it got a lot of hits.
Oh, yeah.
And
I think every teacher I ever knew.
It's been passed around. Yeah, yeah. That poem, and here's what I wrote about in the book, What Teachers Make, In Praise of the Greatest Job in the World. One of the things that book is the story of that poem and how it got, for a while, separated from me and got anonymously sent around the internet.
Right.
As one of those, it's called the most forwarded poems in the world. Mm-hmm. Who knows whether that's true? It's easy to claim and hard to prove.
Well, and close behind it is The Impotence of Proofreading. That one's my favorite.
No, it's called The Impotence of Proofreading. And I'm totally going to have to do that today for these English teachers. These are my people.
Oh yeah. Why did you, I've got a lot of different questions where I could go with this. Why did you stop teaching?
Okay.
In the classroom. I mean, okay. particular. That made sense.
It does. And it's a question that I always expect. And I used to interpret the question as being much more combative, mm-hmm. than like people, and sometimes it has been. You know, you call yourself such a great inspiration to teachers. If that's so true, if you were so great a teacher, why did you stop teaching? That's not the way you asked it, and I appreciate it.
I adjuncted for a while, and there was a reason I quit.
Oh, adjuncting is a different, and that's slavery without health insurance.
Yep.
You know, because the best slave owners offered health insurance. No, that's horrible. The truth of the matter, The first answer to that question, why did I stop teaching in the classroom, is because it looked like I could, because it looked like there wasn't, because it looked like I had a chance to make a living as a poet, and mm-hmm. being a regular classroom teacher and being a professional spoken word poet,
right.
This is the road less traveled. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to be on my deathbed and think I never gave it a shot.
Right.
So there was a guy who called me an agent. He fancied himself an agent. And he said, you know what? I could get you a lot of these gigs. And I had had somebody, when I was teaching, I had this guy call me up and said, I saw you at the National Poetry Slam Championships. What would it take to get you to come to North Dakota and perform at my university?
Right.
And I said, I really can't come because it's April. This is a very important time. Mm-hmm. I need to be here. I could come in June. He said, I don't want you in June. All my students are gone. I want you in April. I'll pay you $1,000. It's like, no, I can't do it. It's not a question of money. He said, I'll pay you $1,500 and your airfare and I'll put you up. I said, no, I can't. I really can't right. do it. I'll pay you $2,000.
Oh my God.
And I said, and I hung up the phone. I couldn't do it. But I hung up the phone saying, could I command a price of $2,000 and have all my expenses paid?
Right.
If I could put together 14 of those in a year, that would be what I make as a teacher now.
Right.
So I think I gave it another year, and this agent said, you know, I could get you 14 gigs.
Right.
But you can't have a day job. So that was in the year 2000. Mm-hmm. So I've been doing this ever since. And here's the second way I could answer that question. I'm always teaching.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't mean that I get invited to come and teach, because that is what I do. I'm now an itinerant creative writing teacher.
Exactly.
And so I get to teach. I'm like a grandparent, though. I have all of the joys of teaching, but not as many of the responsibilities.
Yeah.
But even when it's just me reciting poetry, I still feel like I'm teaching.
Right. No, I think that's an important way to look at it. And I think it's valuable, because I don't know what your experience was like in high school, but my experience in high school was almost like the slow assassination of poetry and literature.
Well, you know, Billy Collins, my mentor, says high school is where poetry goes to die.
Yeah, and because, you know, I was not a great student in high school. It's terrible.
Or college, you say?
Apparently, it's not. But I was always reading, always interested in reading, and I was fairly skilled at writing. But I wasn't going to recopy those Warner grammar textbooks and everything because I hated those exercises, so I didn't do my homework, of course. But then we'd get into the literature classes, and because the teacher was processing six classes of 25 students a day, it got to the point, and some of them had been doing this for, you know, 20 years, got to the point where they were just trying to steer students to the meaning and interpretation that was written out in the teacher's textbook because he didn't have to think about it and engage in the discussion all the time and drive the students or whatever. And I was sitting in the back going, I don't think that's what that story means. And
they weren't interested.
And it was, and I could see other students around it where they would have a way they wanted to interpret the story, but they were kind of pushed away from that. And so they began to think, I'm not smart enough to understand great literature, or I don't, fuck it, I don't like great literature. And so they stopped reading, they stopped being interested in literature. And that almost happened to me. And then I got to K-State, and I'd always been writing short fiction. And I saw that I could major in English creative writing. I thought, all right, I'll go do that. And took the Intro to Lit Studies class with Carol Franco. And
I know the name.
And one of the first things she kind of pointed out to us was that whatever's in the story, whatever you think is in the story is there. You just have to back it up. And the little light bulb went out in my head, and I thought, it's just like creative writing. As long as I can back it up, it's there. Yay!
And that's what, you know, what a travesty that your high school teacher didn't had, you know, six classes of 25 kids. They, with 150 kids, they can't, especially after they've been doing it for 20 years. Right. They couldn't be bothered to coax that out of you and say, well, Jason, if that's the thesis you want to write about, right, you just back it up.
And so someone like you that goes around and is just pushing the poetry and just teaching that and the joy of it and the pleasure of it and the passion for it, that's as important as standing in a classroom and managing 200 students a day.
Well, I hope so.
I think it is. I think that's one of the other questions I'd like to get to at the end. It's one of those important things for the survival of society is a love of literature, of stories. That's the thing that separates us from the animals. It's not tool use. It's not language. It's storytelling.
Mm.
It's poetry. When I talked with Ed Skoog on the podcast a while back,
he said, I love him.
The whole reason language was invented was so that we could write poetry. And I was like, exactly. It's not about, you know, the machinations of politics and whatever. Language is about poetry, period. If you misuse it for anything else, that's a sin.
Well, that sounds like something Ed Skoog would say, and it's great, except he's wrong.
Oh, really?
Language. He said language. Mm-hmm. Language exists.
For poetry.
Yeah, no, he's right. Writing was invented to keep track of debt.
Yeah.
And that's why poetry and written poetry and spoken poetry, I am trying to capture the feeling of my words, mm-hmm, in symbols that were invented to keep track of how much you owe me.
Right.
There's a tension right there. Okay, listen, we're going to take a break and go and have lunch.
Okay.
And then when we come back, you will have seen me speak to the English teachers. Are you ready for that?
I'm ready. Are you?
I'm ready. Let's go have lunch.
Yeah, you're a rock star.
Oh, sorry to make you sit through that.
Not at all. Not a problem. It was we might have a little bit of a volume problem there. Oops. Oh, that will be fine.
Here we are, hours later.
Yeah, no, that was amazing.
Well, those are English teachers. They are my people. So I give them my best work, and then they stand in line.
Yeah, you nailed your audience. You know exactly who they are.
It's funny. Last summer, I was reading for the 3,000 English teachers who show up in Louisville, Kentucky to grade the AP English exam. They grade 1,000,000 AP English exams. Great stories that they told me about the things that students write in those essays, students who know they're going to fail. And they say, dear AP reader, I know I'm going to fail this, so let me tell you what happened last week.
Right.
And just this, you know, they say some of the stuff they read is haunting and brilliant and wonderfully written, and they have to give it a zero because it doesn't, you know, fulfill the requirements of the assignment. But I'm doing a reading there at night. I've got 1,200 people in the audience, and they're all AP English teachers. And I said, this next poem is based in truth. Oh, you know, all of my poems are based in truth. But as Emily Dickinson said, tell all truth, but tell it. And I paused for a second. And the line is, tell all truth, but tell it slant. Mm-hmm. And so I say, you know, as Emily Dickinson said, tell all truth, but tell it. And the entire 1,200 audience go, slant. It's like, oh my God, one of us.
Okay, so what I wanted, the last couple things, I think that's just my microphone. The last couple things I wanted to ask, the thing about being a writer is there's some circumstance, some happenstance to it, but basically you get to choose your own lineage, which writers you descend from, whose inspiration you carry on into the future. So who are your guys? Who are you consider to be your progenitors?
Well, as we were saying before, language was invented to write poetry mm-hmm. and woo women. And writing was invented to keep track of debt
right.
and how much you owe me. And so poetry has twin parents who are separated. Poetry is a very old oral art form mm-hmm. and performative, but it is also a solitary written effort. And so there's always a tension in poetry, as printed in books.
Mm-hmm.
Is this poem hearkening back to the written word or the spoken word? And the twin parents, at least in American poetry, are Emily Dickinson of the written word and Walt Whitman of the spoken word.
Mm-hmm.
And I am certainly more in the Walt Whitman's vein. And then I'm confessional and I'm narrative. So in more recent generations, Billy Collins is mm-hmm. my guy. He's my mentor. And even though we disagree on all kinds of things, I once asked him, do you ever rehearse for your readings? And he said, no, because every reading is sort of a rehearsal for the next. And how I read a poem out loud on any given night is really incidental, because the poem exists here in the book. And that's when I knew, okay, we are completely different beasts,
right.
because for me, the poem exists here in the air. And I have college students come up to me sometimes and say, hey, you know, we read this poem of yours in class, and I'm writing an essay about it, so I looked it up on YouTube, and I watched it, and that was different than the way it appears in the book. And then I was very excited to hear you do that tonight live, and your live performance was different than the other two. So mm-hmm. which one is the definitive version? And of course, to a spoken word poet, the definitive version is the one I'm doing
right
now. So I denied her question.
That's
Billy Collins is my main. Billy says that he uses humor to invite the audience into the poem.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they are inside the poem, he locks the door and pulls out the sharp knives. And so, you know, there needs to be a little bit of humor just to invite the person in. And
right.
Too many poets are afraid of being understood,
mm-hmm.
so they deliberately obfuscate their meaning, or else they're in their search for beauty, they end up writing lines that are really only decipherable to themselves.
Right.
I think I said there was a woman who, in fact, at the end of the Bouquet of Red Flags is my most recent book, and it comes out tomorrow, November 1st. Although I have copies. And you do too, right? We talked about that.
Yep.
And at the end of Bouquet of Red Flags, in the acknowledgments page, I thank Billy Collins, and I say, and thanks to the woman who, after one of my readings, told me that I was just like Billy Collins, except even worse. It's one of my best compliments and worst insults. I am exactly like Billy Collins, except even worse.
It's good that you understood that in the moment. I'm not sure I would have. The one signing I did, one time I was in front of a crowd after my novel, I was a blank. And there was a woman that I had talked to, but hadn't really, you know, spent time with. And she came up and put the book down, and I totally blanked on her name. And
you need to have some tricks. You need to be saying, "Oh, it's you.
It's you.
I thought that was you back there."
No.
What did you do? Did you know that you'd seen her before?
Yeah.
You knew that you were supposed to know who she was.
I knew this exactly. I knew it because she used to come into the bookstore when I worked there all the time. So, and she just stood there, and I was like, I just kind of said, "I can't remember your name."
Oh, no. There's no shame in that. And then when she told you, did it make sense?
Yes, it did. And then oddly enough, I was going to a used book sale to help support the Wichita Art Museum, and the book I'd signed for was on the table. It's old.
The book you had signed for her
at that reading was one of the donated books being sold to help the library.
Oh, you feel like she, since you didn't know her name.
Yeah, I think, yeah.
She's like, yeah, I don't really care about this book if he didn't know who I was. Right.
Totally. Yeah. I think that's comes from my lack of a performance background, the ability to improvise and my feet.
Well, here's something, and this was just proven to me 10 minutes ago at the end of the signing line, a young woman who I had met earlier in the day came up and said, "Okay, so here I bought a bunch of books. This one is for so-and-so." And I said, "And is this one for you?" She's like, "Yeah, that's for me." And I was pretty sure her name was Hannah. Mm-hmm. And when you are pretty sure that somebody's name, you should just guess it. We are so afraid that people will be more insulted if we say, "Your name's Hannah, right?" And they go, "No, it's Elizabeth." But just go ahead, because it's actually it's actually more insulting to say, "I'm sorry, I've completely forgotten your name." And if they go, "Hannah," and if you were right, 9 times out of 10, you were right.
Right.
And you should have gone, "Just said it. That's what I was going to say." You don't get credit if you were saying, "That's what I was going to say." Right. And even if it's Heather, you know, "I want to say your name is Hannah." "No, it's Heather." Thank you. You got close, you know? So always take a guess. Pick a guess.
Good piece of advice. I'll keep that in mind.
You should, James.
Thanks, Tom. One of the other questions that I always like to ask people, because it's kind of important coming from my lineage, where I got, because I ended up adopting the Beats and in particular, and up through Ondaatje, most recently, and went to Naropa, the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics.
That's where you met Ann Waldman.
Yep. And part of what's important to that lineage is that social engagement, getting literature out into people and getting it to people who aren't involved with it, that have been denied it, or it's been kept from them, or they mm-hmm. don't feel that they have access to it. And, you know, of course, every year we have the NEA, which has their... the National Endowment for the Arts. They have that little survey they do, and they always hand-wring about how literary reading is going down.
Oh.
And at the same time, we have, you know, things like Amazon is like this pulling massive sales for ebooks. So somebody's reading, but nobody's reading the stuff we think we're doing. So I'm not sure that people say, "Oh, we don't have to worry about it. People are buying books. People are continuing to read." And then you have these reports every year that say literary reading, people that are reading novels and poems, it's like this, and is dropping. And it always kind of seems to me that as writers, we should be more involved in sustainability of our profession.
What, I used to say that part of your job as a poet is to proselytize for the art form of poetry. Mm-hmm. I have lots of opportunities where I bring young poets to perform. For instance, earlier this week, I read at an old folks' home on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, where I've been going for over a decade, every other month or so, with a couple of, you know, sometimes I might have taken a year off if I had a bad year. And I take a different group of young poets to read for these old ladies who, there's nobody there. The youngest woman there is probably 70. Mm-hmm. So I've been going there for 10 years, and I don't think 2002 was probably 12 years. None of the people who were there at the beginning are still alive.
Right.
They've all. And I tell them, you can't say shit. You can say shit once if you pretend you're embarrassed.
Right.
Nothing stronger than that. They can take gritty. They know about they know about sex. They don't care about a little sauciness. Mm-hmm. You know, they've had their hearts broken. No poems about death.
Right.
And so I'll there'll be a young poet at the slam, and I'll say, hey, you want to, because I help run a slam in New York City called Urbana. And I say, hey, you want to come up with me and to read at the old folks home? You can do this, but you can't do that. Can't do that. And if they go, yeah, that leaves me with nothing. And I say, you are worthless to this art form in terms of finding a new audience. Mm-hmm. 'Cause spoken word in itself is a big fish hook to try to get more people hooked on poetry.
Right.
Is that where you were going with this line of questioning?
What is it that writers can do? Because I have some writers kind of say, well, they just need to write more books. And it's like, well, that doesn't get people to read. What can we do to engage the community to, J.K. Rowling writes a book and a bunch of young adult people start reading, you know, and that's great. But are they growing up and starting to read, you know, the books that you and I loved and grew up and read on the sly, you know, when they didn't have all these genres of young adult and now new adult? Have you heard about that one?
New adult?
New adult. It's supposed to bridge the gap after the young adult novels. So it's for like 18 to 25 year olds.
Oh, that's like Bright Lights, Big City. That was a new adult.
And it's like high school, man. I was, you know, trying to read Salman Rushdie and stuff like that because it was transgressive at the time, you know, among at least high school kids that were, you know, struggling to get through, you know, Hemingway short stories and those anthologies. And so I was always curious to ask writers, and I know that because you have this big engagement, this big social engagement, you've been on at least one mission so far to recruit 1,000 new teachers. And some people think we don't need to do anything. And I was just wondering, you know, what else can writers be doing to, you know, raise the flag, get people to pick up a book if they've never picked up a book before, to get out of the genre classifications that publishers want to put on it.
Yeah, I don't think I like that term, new adult.
Neither do I.
New adults should just be reading what adults read. And, you know, and actually I think high school kids should be able to read what adults read. Mm-hmm. And my wife is a publisher, and she's worked for 4 of the major 6 publishers in New York City, and you could probably guess what they are. And
there's only she 5 said, left.
Yeah, after they merge, right? And when Random House and Penguin, both of whom she has worked for, mm-hmm. merged, everybody in the business was hoping that they would call themselves Random Penguin.
Oh, yes. That's my favorite one. Random Penguin.
And but they're Penguin Random House. However, if you look online, there's a clever blog that has taken the book jackets, the cover of some famous Random House books. Mm-hmm. And it's just, there's a, like Where's Waldo, there's a penguin in the back. And there's just like a random penguin on the cover of all of these books. I think 2 things. One is you mentioned that I did use my poetry to try to convince 1,000 people to become teachers. And I found that was great because it gave me a reason to write. It gave mm-hmm. me a different reason. I was using my poetry to try to get people to try out a career in education. And I found that was useful to to be have a purpose larger than myself and my own ego. And then the other thing is making it easier for people to consume your writing. So I run a series in New York called Page Meets Stage, and that encourage and I think shows academic and literary poets how to be better at presenting
right.
their work. I tweeted a very short poem last April that went like this. I am the poem in the New Yorker that you read to see if maybe now you finally like poetry. You were hoping I would make sense. However, the wind. And according to me, the world doesn't need more poetry like that.
Yeah. Well, you have to get out of here soon. Do we have a quick moment to, would you like to read
to
a poem?
To end with a poem?
Yeah, this, I actually, because I'm curious, because reading you and hearing you is very different. And this one, The Topless Photograph, is one of my favorite poems. And I was wondering if you would mind reading that.
Chance Briggs was this guy I knew at Bowdoin College. And Juliet was a girl, a young woman of my class, and I kind of had a crush on her. Mm-hmm. And Chance was a year older, and he was a photographer. And I remember going over to his dorm room, and he had all these great black and white photographs. And there was a black and white photograph of Juliet, topless, taken from the back, mm-hmm. And I was just mesmerized. I was like, how did you get to see Juliet naked, you know? And he said, oh, yeah, we went skinny dipping. It's like, you went skinny dipping, you know? And it's just, how did this guy who I thought was gay, you know, maybe that was part of it. I don't know. So I wrote a poem on this called Topless Photograph of Juliet, taken by Chance Briggs. Juliet, wearing nothing but her beautifully too big beltless jeans, stands facing the gray sky, darker sea, white-topped waves of the Atlantic. Her breasts are black and white, or would have been had she chanced to face the camera, not the sea and not the sky. I see her back through Chance's photographic eye. Chance had this way with women. They would sooner skinny dip with him than anything else. I thought he was gay, but in this photograph, I see it was just a kind of grace that I could never hope to fake. Juliet is combing the tips of her long and salty hair, black wet where she grips her ponytail, and I can see sparkling droplets of water make their way down her bare back over chilly and tightly focused goosebumps under the rim of denim to where it must be warm. This photograph has something in it that I thought or hoped I'd lost. I think of it, and Juliet's back. I think of it, and Juliet's back, over and underexposed. Listen to me. I think of how, with her elbows over her head, pointing to both corners of the sky, there would be no shadows on the other side, no place where skin folds in upon itself, perhaps just the smoothest suggestion of smiles. And how can I help but think of the wind whipping up the main coast, toying with the delicate tips of the white caps in the waves of the gray Atlantic? There's so much of a horny 19-year-old boy going on in that.
Yeah, but yeah. There's also that there's a youthful romance that kind of almost a nostalgia for, because I don't think you wrote that when you were 19.
No.
A little older, so there's that hint of nostalgia. Because I've been thinking about that a lot lately as I get older. You know that even though you get into a new relationship, you start something like that, nothing's quite ever as intense as it is when you're 19 and you start falling in love for that first time and you realize that this whole mysterious world in that other body.
Well, recent research indicates that the teenage brain there's something that happens in the teenage brain that makes everything seem so important. And this is the greatest and everything is the most. And you've ruined, Mom, you've ruined my life. And that is such a powerful, those are some of our most vivid memories of those teenage years. But I'm not sure that that's the best time to write about them.
Right.
Listen, the Greek Orthodox monks are waiting for me.
Thank you very much, Taylor. I love that poem, and thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
My pleasure, Jason.
All right, there you have it, episode 23 of the Outrider podcast. I hope you had a good time with that one. I had a good time talking to Taylor. And let's see. In a couple of weeks, we'll have another Shop Talk with Laura Holly, and then after that, we'll be talking with Peyton Marshall, who is the author of the debut novel, Good House. It's very good, and we'll talk to her coming up in December. Welcome. See you in a couple weeks.